Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, Ethics Part 2, and this will end the new material for the course. On Monday, I will review for the final exam. I'll tell you what I expect you to know for the final exam. And then on Wednesday, it is up to you to ask me questions about the final exam. Is this going to be on the exam or is that? If it's not, I'll say no. And if you want to see examples of problems, I'll do that on Wednesday. Then on Friday, one last quiz, sort of an overview, a warning kind of preparation quiz, just to get you ready for that final exam. And then your class has its final exam on Tuesday of exam week at 7:50 in the morning, of all things. So 7:50 to 9:50 on Tuesday, you'll have your final exam in this class. So come early and often for the final, obviously. And from there, we're going to have a quick look at the markets, and then I'll get the lecture finished up, and you can be on your way to this gorgeous day outside. The markets are in a really sour mood, and they're all down just about the same amount, closing in on 2.5% down, a really strong, hard wind pushing markets down. And as far as equity markets go, so there's investors are getting out of stocks and moving their money to something else. Well, crude oil is having a bad day. It's still above $100 a barrel, but it is very the market is soft right now because, as I had said before, the idea that we were going to stop all the oil coming out of Russia was just a temporary pipe dream. Countries are cheating and getting oil from Russia, and Russia's figuring out all these different ways it can get oil out by changing the flags of its oil carriers and stuff like that. So oil is going to be quiet for a while, but it'll pick back up here in due time. Interestingly, the money that is going out of equities is not going into the metals at all. You can see that they're down pretty good, pretty solid down days too. Now, the 10-year bond is, the yield is down to about one basis point, and that means that there was a minor price increase. It's not significant at all. And so a lot of the money is going to the sidelines. It's not going anywhere. It's going into cash. And that's exactly what I've done is I've moved all of my equity positions, everything, into cash, just waiting to see what happens next. One thing we have was that the chairman of the Federal Reserve doubled down today, or I think it was early this morning, and said, look, we're going to just keep the lid on the money supply. We're going to contract until we get this inflation out of the economy. And he was hinting at a 50 basis point increase in the discount rate coming up, which is more than the usual. Usually, if it's going to go up, it'll go up by 0.25%. Well, he's saying we're going to put it up 0.5% to get this inflation under control. Now, if you look over here at the 10-year bond, at the bonds, you see that we had still an inversion on the 7/10. It was trying to get back, but all the others had straightened themselves up to a normal yield curve. But there we go. Yesterday, 2.87 on the 5, 2.88 on the 7, 2.85. There's the inversion on the 10. But look what happened last night. By last night, the 5-7-year leg had flattened, and it's going to go back to an inversion. And that will add to the inversion that is on the 7 to 10-year leg. So we are very likely going to have a recession, probably, as I had said, at the beginning of next year. And the reason is clearly the Fed is raising interest rates across the board, and it is going to keep those interest rates up there, slow down the economy, choke off the inflation, and then everyone's going to be pissed off because, well, the economy is going to the toilet. Well, you were the ones who wanted those COVID checks. You were the ones who wanted those low tax rates for corporations. Well, guess what? The money supply was expanded massively, and now we have to contract it, and guess what? That's a recession. So there you go. Get ready for the fun that's coming up. Can't say much more about it, but you have the tools now. You know what to do. You know how to look at this, so I need not take you any further. You can see for yourself what's coming at us. In order to finish this ethics lecture, I have a few last terms that I need to get into play so that you have the inventory for the rest of the lecture. And as I had said before, I had always anticipated, well, I had anticipated until a few years ago, that your business law class, your legal environment of business class, was going to introduce you to all of this, and I have found out that that is not the case. So I have to do this preliminary legwork here in order to get you ready to see what is called the agency dilemma. The first one I've already mentioned in this class on a couple of occasions, the term person. Person in technical terms, in law, is any entity that is definable under law, under common law or statutory law, whatever. So a person could be an individual. A person could be the board of directors of a company. A person could be a corporation. A person could be a contract. A contract can be a person if it defines an association of something, a collection of things for some legal purpose. So the person I'm talking about here could be an individual, but it doesn't have to be an individual. This became a problem, as I had mentioned earlier, because over decades, the Supreme Court of the United States and lower courts had begun this process of recognizing more and more rights, constitutional rights, of corporations and companies as if they were people. And it was because of their application of this term person to these corporations. So about a little more than a decade ago, they said, well, corporations have free speech, so they can contribute as much as they want to political candidates. And so you have this era now where these massive pools of money can essentially write elections, decide who's going to win at this point, because the Supreme Court has assigned personhood to a corporation, and therefore that person has constitutional rights just like a human being does. That's something that someone else is going to have to solve. That's not my job to solve that here. Now, the next one I'm going to go into, which is important for this lecture, is a contract. A contract is a type of agreement. There are many agreements that aren't contracts. In fact, there are agreements that are quasi-contracts. But in order to be a full contract, four pillars must be met. Now, some law books will say three. There are some law professors who say 12. Four is a pretty decent number. The four are, first of all, one, there must be an offer and an acceptance. And the offer must be serious and genuine and all that, and the acceptance must be clearly made. But it would surprise you what is an offer and what is not an offer. So, for example, take this one. You go to McDonald's, and you look up on the menu, and I am your McDonald's cashier, and I say, may I McHelp you? And you say, why, McYes? I would McLike a McCheeseburger. And I say, McGreat. That'll be $1.85. And you say, Mick, okay, here's your money. Okay, so now, I was looking up, you were looking up there at the menu. So that was the offer, right? What was on the menu? And the price. Actually, no, that was not the offer. You made the offer to me. You see, because an advertisement, unless it is really specific, is not an offer. That's why you have to be a little careful when you do advertisements so that they don't meet the technical definitions of an offer. It would have to have said, for example, the quantity. It would have had to give some explanation of the ingredients or whatever. It did not. It was just a solicitation for you to make an offer. And so when you said, I would McLike a McCheeseburger, that was the offer. And when I said, McOkay, that was the acceptance there. So you've got to be a little careful about what is offer and what is acceptance. Now, here's another one that we can take on. A situation like this one here. You have a $5,000 car listed on Craigslist for $5,000. So I come to you and I look at that car and I say, I'd like $4,000. I'll pay you $4,000. And you say, no, $5,000 firm. Okay, so did I accept your $5,000 in the first round? No, you see, because when I offered, counter-offered $4,000, that killed your offer. Your offer is gone. The $5,000 offer is now gone. The $4,000 is my counteroffer, and you accepted my offer. So a counteroffer kills an offer immediately. Once you have made a counteroffer, there is no more offer on. Well, you offered me $5,000 first, and now you've sold it to someone else. Well, no, I offered it first. No, because I countered with $4,000. That killed your offer to me of $5,000. So you're free to sell it to someone else for $5,000. I cannot come back to you and say, well, you already offered. No, it's gone. That offer is dead right there at that point. So do know that an offer can be a little bit hard to define for the non-technical person. There's another one. Sometimes offers accepted, except that. No, once you've said accept that, that offer is not accepted. It is killed. When you have made an exception, unless it's a very trivial exception, it's killed. Now, offer and acceptance. This can surprise you. First of all, understand something. Written contracts are not the only contracts. Most of your contracts that you will engage in your life are oral contracts. And an oral contract is fully legitimate and has just as much quality as a written contract. In some cases, an oral contract is more desirable. You see, because in a written contract, there's a rule called the parole evidence rule, the four corners doctrine. In a written contract, if it is not in the four corners of that written contract, it is not part of the contract. Well, you know, I know it's not in the contract, but we discussed that. It doesn't matter. If it's not in the contract written, if it's a written contract and it's not in there, you might have discussed it for days. You might have even shaken hands on it. Doesn't matter. If it's not in the written contract, it's not there. So know this, that oral contracts are perfectly legitimate. And a contract doesn't have to be typed on a piece of paper. It could be a napkin. A good example. Well, I'll give you an example of that later. But do understand that some contracts aren't even stated as contracts. They can be implied by law or implied by the customs and traditions. So, for example, last evening I went to get my hair done. See how great my hair, look at this. And I just went in and I sat down in a chair and the hairdresser came up and she said, well, let's go back. And so she did my hair. Now, could I have said, well, we didn't agree to anything. I'm not paying you for what you just did here because we didn't make no agreement. That's absolutely false. There was a contract. It was implied, and it was fully valid that I owe her because of the rule of oral contracts implied by law or implied by custom. So know this, that a contract doesn't even have to be explicitly stated to exist. When I got that McDonald's cheeseburger, when you got that McDonald's cheeseburger, we didn't sign some, wherefore the party to the hunger shall be rendered a McCheeseburger by the party to the McCheeseburger provider. There wasn't anything like that in writing or orally. You just ordered. And it was a perfectly valid contract. It was executed, it closed, and everyone went away McSatisfied. The next pillar of a contract is mutual exchange of value. Thing of value for thing of value. I give you, madam, an engagement ring. Oh, that's gorgeous. Oh, look at that. And I say, okay, when should we get married? You say, oh, we're not going to get married. Wait, now see here, woman. You just take the ring and sell it. You see, oh, well, we had an agreement. We had a contract. No, we don't. A gift does not create a contract. Acceptance of a gift does not bind a contract. A gift is not setting up a contract under any circumstances whatsoever. If you give something away without some explicit agreement, understanding that there's a thing of value for a thing of value, that there was an offer and acceptance, and a few other things here, it is not a contract at all. So you be careful about when you give gifts, because the person who, the recipient, owes you nothing if there's not an explicit understanding that is probably in writing or at least orally with witnesses and all that. So it has to be a thing of value for a thing of value in order for it to be a contract. Now, the next one here is an interesting animal, capacity. Now, you have to be a little careful with this, because I am not talking about any law that would have to do with sex acts in this one. But capacity would have to do with, for example, drunkenness. In and of itself, being drunk does not make a contract voidable. I signed it when I was blottoed. I signed it when I was wasted. I signed it when I was shit-faced. Doesn't matter. You see, that's not enough to say capacity is diminished enough. You have to get a little further than that. Now, here's where this comes into play, kind of important, because in the capacity, many, many years ago, it was actually unlawful. It was prohibited for people with mental disabilities or mental diminishment to get married. They could not. They were considered incapacitated to form a marriage contract, Down syndrome people. They couldn't understand, so they had no capacity for this. Those laws have changed dramatically over the years in most states so that, under many circumstances, it's quite okay. But there are still, and here's an interesting case of that. Out of Georgia many years ago, two couples, they lived right next to each other. They always got met on Friday nights to get drunk and play games and all that. And at one point during an evening, the guy who was hosting the party that night, he was talking about what a wreck his house was, and I'd sell it to you for $1. And the guy said, well, put it in writing. And so he wrote, I sell this house to you for $1. And he gave the napkin to the other guy. Well, the other guy came over the next day when they were all sober, and he said, here's $1. I want my house. Please sign the title over. No. I mean, I was drunk. I mean, that wasn't it. He had to sell the house for $1. Because not only was it, he couldn't claim incapacitation from drunkenness, he wrote it down for God's sake, which made it even tighter, more clearer that this was a contract. And capacity, drunkenness was not sufficient to void the contract in that case. So you be careful about that. When you're signing things, sometimes you can't go back and say, well, I was too drunk or I was too stoned. You might not get that to work in a court of law. Now, capacity falls apart when you get down to people who are not of legal age. In fact, a contract with a minor is voidable in general, unless it is for a necessity of life. A contract with a minor is voidable at the discretion of the minor. So if you are a 17-year-old and I sell you, I'm a merchant, I sell you a pack of gum, you can chew that gum, then bring it back to me and put it on the table and say, I want my money back. I hereby void that contract that we had for the sale. Because, you see, you did not have the capacity, so it was voidable at your discretion. So this is a warning to you in business. Be careful when you are doing business with minors, because contracts are voidable unless, like I said, it's for something like rent or desperation of food, something like that. Otherwise, it's voidable at the discretion of the minor. He can just void it at his discretion within reason. So capacity is a tricky one here. Be careful. You're going to be leaders. You're going to be business people. Know that you have to have an edge, a hard edge on you when you are talking about contracts. The last one is legality. Legality is a risky one if you are a drug dealer. You sold me a dime bag, man, and that wasn't even weed. That was, I think that was like rosemary in there that you chopped up. And it really, well, it got me high, dude, but I mean, you see, and I'm going to take you to court under contract. No, because it was an illegal act. Prostitution would fall under that. And I won't get into any details of that, even though there are phenomenally fun examples of that. But legality is definitely, the contract must be for something that is legal. Can't be something illegal. So those are four pillars of which we, for what we're going to do here. Now, yes. Now, let me do something here. I'm going to write two words on the board, agent and principal. Now that's with P-A-L. The agent is a person, remember I talked about person, charged with maximizing the welfare in some regard, like wealth or something, or health, of an other person. That other person is the principal. The board of directors is, and notice I'm using the singular, because the board of directors is a person under law. The board of directors is the agent of the shareholders as a person. The shareholders as a body is a person. And the board of directors, as a body, is a person. The board of directors is charged with maximizing the wealth of the stockholders. Period. That's classic corporation law. Other ones that would be in play, too. A doctor and a patient. Let's try this. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a doctor-patient relationship? Yes, the patient is the principal. The doctor is charged with maximizing the health of the patient. And therefore, the doctor is the agent and the patient is the principal. The same would be true in a lawyer-client relationship. The lawyer is the agent maximizing the welfare of his client, who would be the principal. Now, here's an interesting one. Here's one to try out. Sir, parent-child relationship. Who is the agent and who is the principal in a parent-child relationship?
Parents probably the agent.
not probably, is, no question. In law, this is, in law, the parent is charged with maximizing the welfare of the child. That means the parent is the agent, the child is the principal. Now, here's one we can try out. In a marriage, you know, husband, wife, who's the agent and who is the principal? And I caution you to be careful with what you say. Who is the agent and who's the principal in a marriage? Well, that's new. I haven't ever heard that one before. That offer and acceptance and all that. But that's the contract. Okay. Actually, the husband and the wife are both the agents. The marriage is the principal. A marriage doesn't have to be a living thing. Both the husband and the wife are charged with maximizing the welfare of the marriage. The same would be true of a soldier. A soldier is the agent of the Constitution of the United States. We swear an oath to that Constitution. The soldier is there to maximize the welfare, the survivability, and the strength of the Constitution of the United States, defining the Republic. And to put it in blunt terms, many years ago, a president was alleged to have said the Constitution is nothing but, quote, a goddamn piece of paper. And everyone was shocked that he would say something like that. In fact, he was absolutely right. The only reason the Constitution has life is through the agents who maximize its welfare. The agents who are the soldiers, the agents who are the citizens. All of us are the agents maximizing the welfare of our nation as citizens and soldiers. So that takes us to into a fascinating realm that this, what I'm going through here, agency, is a broad understanding, and it is in common law. The ancient law that carries underneath all of the written laws is this ancient tribal law we call common law that carries with it the strength of the bindings among people. Law itself comes from an ancient word that was the base language of many of the languages of the world, a language called Proto-Indo-European. We hear it in all these different words. Lex, law. Law, ligature, ligament, all these bindings of people together. This is how we bind, is through the contracts. Oral, written, whatever. Implied by law, implied by fact, whatever. This is where it all begins. And in our world, in business, we have to recognize this every day that we function. Here's the problem, though, and this isn't just in business. Let me give you an example. The parent-child relationship. The parent is the agent who is charged with maximizing the welfare of his children. So that means, and here's a typical night when you get older and you have kids. You come staggering in, you're tired, you're worn out, you're just exhausted, you flop down in your chair. Oh, God. And there are your kids going crazy, bouncing up and down the couch, swinging from the chandeliers, climbing the walls, doing all kinds of mayhem. Now, what you should do as the principal, or rather as the agent, is just take those kids and come on, let's give us a huggy. Let me fix you a nice, nutritious meal, and then, you know, we'll give you your baths, and I'll read bookies to you. I love you so much. Maximize your welfare. Well, here's what you're going to do. Oh, God, you kids, stop it. Stop it. You, quit it. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself. You're bad. That's what you're going to do. Here, I'm going to fix you some nuke and puke, and then you go wash your face and crawl into bed. Damn it. You're going to do that instead of what you should do. Agents have an incentive to maximize their own welfare instead of the principal's. That is called the agency dilemma. Agency dilemma. An agent always has incentive to maximize its own welfare. Instead of the principles. That is the agency dilemma. In other words, well, I trust you. You're not going to screw me over. You're going to do everything right. You're my agent. Yeah. No, I can't do that. You cannot do that. That is irrational. You must assume whether or not the agent really is a good person or a bad person. You cannot make an assumption. You have to understand that the agent has an incentive, always has an incentive to maximize its own welfare. We must bring this down to numbers, though, in finance, in business. Before I do that, though, understand that in a normal agency, the principal is responsible for monitoring and enforcement of the contract with the agent. That's that vicarious liability that I talked about before. It's the principal's duty, not the agent. The agent has an incentive to screw up, but it is the principal's job to make sure that does not happen. In a normal agency relationship. And I'll tell you the exception here in a few minutes. Long time ago, in my early years as a consultant, I had a gig up in upstate New York, bring together some capital for a slaughterhouse butcher shop that was operating up there. It was actually, it was a decent-sized operation. Had about 42 people that were working there, and they really didn't do the slaughterhouse part, but they did the butchering of the meats when they had finished bleeding out and all of that. And so the problem that they were having was that they needed the money to get a surveillance system. CCTV cameras, because they were just bleeding theft from the employees. The jokes were that guys would come in with short sleeve shirts on and leave with long sleeve shirts, and they had big muscles. They were wrapping stakes around their arms. You know, the ladies would come in skinny, and they'd leave with a belly because they were hiding a roast under it. It was just one of those things where, yeah, there was a lot of theft going on. And so they wanted the money to get a CCTV system for the floors of the for the cutting floors, and for the hallways and for the parking lot. Here's the problem, though, is they had not thought it through clearly. You don't have to just buy a CCTV system. You're going to have trained people, security, watching the monitors at all times. And then, okay, there's your monitoring all the time, watching your employees. And then what happens if you see someone walk out into the parking lot and you suspect that that person is hiding a roast under her shirt? Are you really going to take the chance on the liability from searching that person? Really? Yeah, have you thought this through at all, what this is going to cost in terms of liability insurance, in terms of employee costs for security guards and all of that kind of stuff? Monitoring and enforcement can be a terribly expensive thing. Are you really going to save enough money to make it worth this? Net present value of the project and all of that kind of stuff. Replacement. Replace no system with an expensive system. Fortunately, a young man, he was the son of one of the founders, came up with an idea, and he brought it up. He said, why don't, instead of we doing all of this monitoring enforcement, why don't we just have Free Meat Fridays? On Fridays, all of the employees can take home 5 pounds of whatever meat they want, steaks, ground beef, roast, whatever, just every Friday. And at first there was, oh, that's ridiculous. And finally it took hold at that meeting. You saw more people getting on board. And I'll be darned if that didn't work. The theft went down. You turned an illegal agency act into a legitimate benefit of working there. And the cost went down because people weren't constantly trying to steal food and all that. They knew on Fridays they'd get meat for the weekend and maybe enough for a few days into the week. So you have to think about monitoring and enforcement. What's the marginal cost of greater monitoring and enforcement? And you have to do both. You can't do just one. Versus what is the marginal benefit that you're going to get from it? So it's a balancing act, this part right here. Now, in finance, as I have said on more than one occasion, we need to get from fuzzy words to money numbers. Tell me how much this costs in terms of agency. So in other words, when we're talking about agency dilemma and these maximizing their own welfare, the agents are, we have to liquidate that down to agency costs, and there are five of them. The first one is perquisites, what are oftentimes called perks. These are wrongful benefits as a result of position. Wrongful benefits as a result of position. This is the CEO who has a desk that's so large you could land a small plane on it. This is the, I'll give you a good example. Years back, I was at a dinner with these executives, and they said, you know, why don't you quit teaching? You're not making anything there. You can become our new comptroller. We need one. I said, you don't want me to do that. Because you guys take trips first class to all of your meetings. You don't need to do that. Greyhound goes everywhere. And you're staying at five-star hotels. Come on. You don't need to do that. Motel 6, it works. And you even have that quarter machine to make you happy. And these five-star restaurants, for God's sake, Denny's has Grand Slams for $3.99. Back then they were. And they did, of course, they thought that was hilarious, and I was being dead serious. You're taking benefits. That is the shareholders' money, for God's sake. Why are you using it for yourself? Oh, it's because you can do that. Even though the principals, the shareholders, are damaged by you doing that, and these massive salaries that are paid, we have tons of evidence that above a certain salary that's well under $1 million, you get no more productivity out of any worker whatsoever. You just don't get it. So when you pay yourself these massive salaries, that shareholder money, that's a perk. You don't need it. It doesn't benefit the corporation. It benefits you, cupcake. That's perks. Now here's another one, shirking. An agency cost. Avoiding your duties as an agent. Shirking. Avoiding your duties as an agent. This is the employee who wanders from one cubicle to the other, chatting everyone up during the day, doing all those kind of fun things, and the extra few minutes on the smoke break or the lunch break and all that kind of stuff. Shirking is an amazingly costly problem. Long ago, I was at another dinner, and there was this kind of upper-level manager, and they were talking about workload, and he said, I make sure my desk is clean every night. I get it all taken care of so I can go home with a clear desk. And then, of course, I was hearing from the others, yeah, that's because at the end of the day, he takes all of his work and he puts it on his subordinates' desks. Shirking. Yeah, every night he does that. I was consulting for one company long, long ago, and there was this one account executive. Every morning, he'd show up at the right time, 8 o'clock, and he'd walk past the receptionist's desk, grab the Wall Street Journal, and he'd go into the men's toilet, and he would be there 45 minutes every day. It was like clockwork. That man had the most regular bowels you could imagine. Shirking. He didn't have to work. He was on the toilet taking a crap every morning. That's shirking. Shirking has all kinds of different aspects to it, but it's avoiding your duties as an agent. the next one. Direct theft, to stealing. The employee who sneaks out with a retail from a retail establishment with a nice shirt or something like that. The professor who grabs a few extra markers just because he has a whiteboard at home that his kids like. That's theft. It's stealing. It's huge. It's a massive multi-billion-dollar problem. And, of course, these companies are always saying, our employees steal so much. Yeah, well, look at the perks and look at the shirking and tell me that they are the real problem. I mean, they're all agents, and they're all extracting their own agency costs. It's just the reality of it. Number four, lying. Avoiding responsibility by assigning it to someone else or just saying it didn't happen. Lying is an enormous problem. It causes extraordinary costs because, first of all, the lying deflects solutions while blame is going around. It also demoralizes the people who are always the whipping boys of the liars in corporations. It is a real cost, and it is really nasty. It is a continuing problem in corporations. And finally, there's one that is fascinating. It's called, have you ever worked in a place where one of your coworkers was dumb as a box of rocks? I mean, that's even disrespecting rocks. The person was so stupid. Incompetence is a major problem. In fact, what's even worse is that incompetence isn't a bug, it is a feature. Know this, that every employee, every agent, is either on his or her way to incompetence or has made it there. Think about it this way. You, madam, I hired you, and it's just like you did everything incredibly well. I mean, you're just an awesome employee. So, meritocracy, you're promoted, and you do great there, as in the finance department. Obviously, you change your major to the finance. And so, you go up the line, and then finally one day, the CFO of the company comes swooshing in. Ba, 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 ba. You have impressed me. And I would like to have you become the assistant chief financial officer. You will get a raise to $500,000 a year plus bonuses. You will also get a company car and keys to the executive washroom. What say you? Join me or die. You know you can't do that job. There's no way you can do it. That's not even what you want to do with your life. Are you going to say no? Remember, you see, you're probably going to say yes. See, rise to your level of incompetence. This isn't just, there was a professor many years ago, a management guru named Dr. Peter, and it's called the Peter Principle. At the time, it was thought that he was being funny. We know now that was, it's not. This is a process. You will rise up. Look at the head football coaches. Most of them are incompetent AF. But they kept rising because they were good as assistant coaches. CEOs of corporations generally are absolute idiots in that position. But they rose there because they were so good that they kept going up the chain. That's incompetence. This is what you face. This is the framework I was talking about yesterday. It sounds evil and cruel, but this is where it breaks down to. You manage the agency costs. That's your job. You are going to have the college degrees. You're going to be the managers. You are going to have people under you, and you're also going to have people over you. These agents are going to try. You have to assume that they are going to extract agency costs. Whether or not they do, well, this could be some fine, upstanding young man right there. I don't think you do anything wrong. That's the wrong attitude. I must assume that you will, and put the controls in place so that you won't do that. This whole framework has one exception. It is so important, I can't believe that it is not emphasized anywhere else in the College of Business. There are times when the principal cannot monitor and enforce. The principal doesn't have that ability. Like a child. A child's principal, he or she doesn't know what the parents should do. A doctor, when you're under anesthetic, you don't know what the doctor's doing, even though he's the agent. You're the principal, it's your responsibility to monitor and enforce. You can't. A lawyer is the principal of the client, but the client doesn't know the law, the lawyer does. In those kinds of relationships where the principal cannot monitor and enforce, we say that it is a fiduciary relationship. A fiduciary. The agent must behave as if the principal. Black's Law Dictionary defines fiduciary duty as the highest duty implied by law. That carries massive weight. Highest means there isn't anything else. And there's not highest here, highest there, we'll take them both. No. And implied means that it is older than written law. Laws can say fiduciary duty, but fiduciary duty carries back to the tribal law, to the law of the bindings of people together, to the code of the knights, to the honor of the people who are the citizens of the country. No law can say this. Fiduciary duty is characterized by trust, loyalty, and fidelity. Fidelity means faithfulness. These are its characteristics in a fiduciary relationship. But as I said, and this is the final point, you can't have the highest here and the highest there. You have to, there's no such thing as, well, they're both highest, but this one's higher now, this one's higher here. You can't do that. I'll tell you a good example, the greatest story I have. I was the CEO of a small corporation. I had the highest duty. Because the shareholders couldn't monitor and enforce, I had to carry it myself as the fiduciary to carry out maximizing their welfare. But then I also had a family, wife and kids. They are a highest, they are a fiduciary. They cannot monitor and enforce me, so I must do it myself as their agent. And therefore, I was carrying highest and highest. And you know what? One night, I had worked really hard, got everything together so that the financials could be published in. So I had fulfilled my fiduciary duty to my corporation, to my shareholders. And so there I could go home and see what I could do for my fiduciary duty to my family. The house was dark. It seemed that I couldn't really carry two fiduciary duties at the same time. My family was gone. Choose your fiduciary relationships carefully and know what is the most important in your life. That's all I have for you. Go home.